Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. This is Friday, and this is the day we do Mythbusters. The co-host is Chris Rossini. And Chris, I understand we might talk a little bit about the 1930s. That sounds like it was before you were even born. But what are we going to deal with and talk about the 1930s?
Yes, good morning, Dr. Paul. Great to be with you again. We're going to cover a big lie that has lasted decades and decades, and it's an important one because it has to do with it has shaped what many people think about the role of government, and that is that FDR saved us from capitalism, which was destroying itself, and from the Hoover administration, which was prior to his, because it was so laissez-faire and hands-off. It's a big lie, so let's tackle it today. And we'll start with Herbert Hoover. Not only was he not laissez-faire, but he intervened like no president before. And even FDR admitted, and I'll quote him, "We didn't admit it at the time, but practically the whole New Deal was extrapolated from programs that Hoover started." Please start there, Dr. Paul.
Yes, that is true. And I can remember when I had an enlightenment on the understanding of this, because it was early on in my study of Austrian economics, I came across Murray Rothbard's book, The Great Depression. And I was raised in a Republican family, and they spoke traditional Republican politics. Even though I was young, I guess I had ears open, I was listening. But the story was that Hoover was a bad president because the Democrats weren't fair to him, and the media didn't treat him right, and there were all kinds of excuses, but he never did anything wrong. So it was a partisan thing. My family was they were partisan Republicans, and of course the Democrats have that same habit. But Hoover was more of a problem than most people realize. He did not believe in laissez-faire. He did not learn the lesson of something he should have learned, because he was very much involved in politics at the time, and that was the depression of 1921 after the World War I. And back then, even though it was the first depression that came after the Fed was organized, they still had an attitude and of hands off. You know, they weren't supposed to do anything. So the depression was bad, but it lasted a short time. Liquidation of debt and liquidation of bad investment, hey, we'll all go back to work. So you'd think that would have been a lesson, because that was the tradition. But when the depression hit, Hoover came in, and he was a super interventionist. There was one program called the Refinance Organization, which it literally sounded like what came out of the financial crisis of 2008. How are we going to finance people? And they financed the bad debt and the farmers. And one thing that there was a lot of this pressure on industry and the farmers, and they said that they wanted higher prices, and they worked with the farmers, and the farmers would do everything possible to get prices up by diminishing production. So they would plow crops under to push prices up, because the farmers were in trouble. Then the government would come along and bail out the farmers with easy loan. So it made no sense whatsoever. And it was hands off. And of course, what Hoover also did, he raised taxes in the midst of all that. You know, today, we're not going to lower taxes, but I hope they have a good enough sense not to raise taxes, but I'm not too optimistic they're going to have a good enough sense to cut the spending. But they also, the Hawley-Smoot tariff was a big issue in the Depression. There's been books written about how things precipitously dropped the day it passed in the Senate, and the day they knew it was going to pass, that the markets went down sharply and the Depression was accelerated. So they did all the things wrong. But you know what was interesting, though, is the election of 1932, Roosevelt was the conservative. He was speaking the game of freer markets and balanced budgets and the gold standard and promising not to go to war, this sort of thing. But Hoover was decent on foreign policy. He did not believe in it. He had a humanitarian instinct, but that also drove him to be humanitarian, which is dangerous in economic policies. Take care of people if they're having problems. That's the government's responsibility. but he was humanitarian driven, and he did come up with reasonable policies dealing with foreign policy, because he wasn't looking to build the military and go overseas. Matter of fact, he tried to bring them back. But in some ways, Hoover sort of fit the bill of what we look at some of the present-day progressives, real liberal on the domestic affairs with less intervention overseas. Of course, that's all changed, because right now we even talk about the Democrats being more militaristic than the Republicans. But anyway, at that day and age, that was his position. All he did was prolong the Depression, made it longer, made it deeper. It was a new test. It was the first time we ever intervened like this in the market. It was always the monetary policy that caused the panics and the recessions and depressions. But usually it was hands off, liquidate, go back to work. But Hoover changed all that. And unfortunately, the discussion of 1932 ushered in the continuation of the Hoover policies.
Yes, and this may surprise a lot of people, but FDR, when he was campaigning, they were complaining about the socialism of the Hoover administration. I'm going to read a quote from FDR just a few weeks before the election. He said, "You can never expect any important economy from this Hoover administration. It's committed to the idea that we ought to center control of everything in Washington as rapidly as possible. I regard reduction in federal spending as one of the most important issues of this campaign." So, Dr. Paul, what did FDR end up doing after he was elected?
Everything opposite. But so he was a traditional politician. But, I recall stories in the family showed there was one member that was a real, real solid Republican. But if you looked at the two policies of Hoover versus Roosevelt, I could understand if you wanted to be involved and you wanted to vote and you were going to take them at their word, you would have had to vote for Roosevelt, because he was still for the gold standard. He was not going to get us into a war, and criticizing Hoover for being too much of an interventionist, and his debt was too high. So he was he had a much better platform, but it really introduced probably the age of fake news, or fake politicians saying one thing and doing another. Of course, that's old hat for so many. But Roosevelt did come in at a time that was very bad. It was made bad by Hoover. It was made bad by Democrats. It was made bad by bad policy. It was made bad by the Federal Reserve. And things got much worse. They did not want to allow wages to go down. They say, keep wages up and never fire anybody. Instead, when you have liquidation, you have to clean up your act and get solvent, get rid of your debt, and start hiring people again and have growth again. But no, they were instructed, don't let the prices go down, and they wanted the prices go high. And as I mentioned, the higher prices by plowing crops under is hardly a way to take care of the poor people, no matter how humanitarian they were in their instincts. It didn't work, and it ushered in the age of Roosevelt, which we have yet to recover from.
Yes. Next, you mentioned the Federal Reserve, and that's going to come into the next topic, and that's gold. When FDR was elected, his party platform, the Democratic Party, said, "We advocate a sound currency to be preserved at all hazards." Now, what happened, Dr. Paul, once right after he got in?
Yeah, very shortly, I think it was in April of 33, they announced just an incidental little executive order. The executive order says, "American people, we're in tough times. Send us the gold. We want your gold." And everybody, marches in and they turn in their gold. Not everybody, but the American people were rather obedient. And the purpose of that was to devise a weaker currency. They took gold at $20 an ounce, put it up to $35 an ounce, allowed them to massively print money and devalue the dollar, and that would, theoretically supposed to help trade favorably for the one with a weaker currency. Of course, the world was in a depression, and there was no magic to that. But, Roosevelt came in. He took the right away of the American people to own gold in April of 1933. And we were not allowed to own gold until the 1970s. In January of 1975, that right was restored. to the American people, which was a significant right, because at least if you want to today, you can be on your personal gold standard, convert your paper money into gold. But you weren't allowed to do that. And that is a very, very authoritarian approach. I think at that time, that period of time, the Soviets and the Americans were one of the very few states that didn't allow their people to own gold. So it was a very authoritarian approach, the worst thing in the world to do if you're looking for sound policy. And then, of course, that led later on. Roosevelt had been long gone, but by 1971, the rest of the gold standard was removed because Americans weren't allowed to own gold, so we lost our liberties, but foreigners could do it. If you were a foreigner in a bank, in a central bank, you could turn in $35 and get an ounce of gold, but we weren't allowed to do that. By 1971, we were running out of gold. We were down to, it was reduced by about 70%. So that's when Nixon closed the gold window. The restoration of the ownership of gold has been a very positive thing. But we have a long way to go to restore an honest gold standard that would be supported by our government.
Finally, we're going to talk about war. And following the horrific decision of Woodrow Wilson to enter World War I, Americans realized that they were duped. The world was not made safe for democracy. It wasn't the war to end all wars by any stretch. And there was a lot of anti-war sentiment in the country. FDR was a part of it. He said, quote, "We shun political commitments which might entangle us in foreign wars. We are not isolationists except insofar as we seek to isolate ourselves completely from war. I hate war." Yet behind the scenes, FDR was a part of the Navy and helped create it, the biggest Navy in the world, even bigger than the British Empire. So please talk about that, Dr. Paul.
Yeah, that's discouraging because I struggled with that for a long time when I started reading historians that were going over this and painting a different picture. I said, it's impossible. No individual could possibly, behind the scenes, develop a strategy to put us into war because it was so devastating. But I've come around to believing, yes, Roosevelt really did lead us into that war. And his strategy, I'm sure, was for the better good of the world because there were bad enemies out there and the American people had to be behind it. He knew that the America Firsters of the 1930s were very strong and they did not want war, so they had to be convinced, as they always have to be. The natural instinct for the people is not to go to war. It kills people and it costs a lot of money and that sort of thing. So he had to develop a public relations where the American people were all for that. So he actually did, I believe, get us into war deliberately, and that we were knowledgeable about what was going to happen at Pearl Harbor. But it's interesting that the populist movement, you can go all the way back to Williams Jennings Bryan leading up to the Spanish-American War, there was a populist anti-war movement then, because that was the introduction to our international foreign policy at the time, and they stood against all that. And of course, in the 1930s, it was very, very strong, but it was totally destroyed once Pearl Harbor was bombed. But the instinct was away. So the populace, whether it was William Jennings Bryan or the populist spirit in the late 1930s, they were very, very much anti-war, and they were not militant. And I think Hoover was sort of still part of that. But today, the populist streak that is appearing on the surface, it's interesting, there's two people, the Republican streak of populism that's in office right now versus the populism of Bernie Sanders. It was the Bernie Sanders position of populism. He was more anti-war than the Republican position. But generally speaking, though, if you go back to Huey Long, was strongly anti-war, and I was fascinated, which I've mentioned before, that Huey Long was going to pick Smedley Butler as his Secretary of War, so you know how much anti-war he was. So this is interesting to me that currently today, just because you're a populist, it doesn't mean that you accept the populist traditional position of being opposed to foreign wars. And of course, the populist streak also has said that they endorse the position of the government printing money and also some attack on the Federal Reserve. They've traditionally have done that, but they're not embarrassed by printing a lot of money if you need to bail out farmers or whatever. So we live in a day today which is very much involved with the reaction to the conditions of this country, the conditions of bankruptcies, economic malaise, severe, many people unemployed that aren't counted, a foreign policy that seems to be totally out of control, and people are looking for answers. There's a lot of anger. But generally, what I see going on is that the populist streak is sort of an adjustment in management rather than looking to the principles of liberty, a strict interpretation of the Constitution, a strict understanding of liberty. I wished I'd hear the word that the government exists there to protect our liberty, rather than saying, we're going to make you safe, and that's why we need more nuclear weapons. And that's why we have to go any place, any time around the world, because there may be an enemy out there. No. The government is supposed to be there. We're supposed to have a government according to our founders and the Constitution and according to the principles of liberty, that the government exists to protect liberty. And if you start with that, believe me, we're going to be a lot safer and a lot more prosperous if we followed those rules. So, Chris, I think that might do it for the day, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Paul.
And I want to thank our audience today for tuning in to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.